Well, we've got a bit of time for questions and comments, and there is a roving mic, and I think it would help if, when you ask a question, A, you make sure it's a question, not just a speech.
But just abuse.
Not just abuse.
Also, I think they wanted the person's name and what they do.
Yep, name would be nice.
I'd like to know what they do as well.
So, got one over there, I think. Perhaps if you stand up to ask. Okay.
Hello there. I'm Robert, and I'm a student, well, previous student at Barton Court Grammar School in Canterbury. And a question that a lot of us were talking about in our philosophy lessons, because I used to study philosophy, and part of that was philosophy of religion. A question that we were often talking about is, does God exist? And I think a lot of young people can get very caught up on that question. And it's at that point that you lose religion altogether and you stop thinking about all the positive parts of religion, like the community and the extra parts that you can get from it. How important do you think that question is, especially for young people? Does God exist?
Your Grace.
I think it's all important, because whatever benefit religion may bring, I don't think it can be defended if at the end of the day it isn't about a reality. And when I set myself to pray, I set myself to listen and to receive. If there were not a reality there, I wouldn't be trying to listen, I wouldn't be trying to receive. My prayer wouldn't make any sense. So somehow, yes, I think that question has to be addressed. I remember one of my student friends saying to me some 40 years ago or more, the difference between us, he said, is that I believe that religion is useful but not true, and you believe it's true but not useful. But yeah. The truth matters, I think.
Yeah, I think the truth matters. I think also, probably in the context of philosophy, you were seeking an objective truth about whether God exists. And I don't think we're going to get that. And I know subjective truth doesn't sound as good, but I think that the challenge is that no one is going to prove whether God exists or not. But I think, like lots of stuff with philosophy, it's a great question. I'd be happy sitting around with you guys at 4 a.m. in the morning trying to work that out. Because sometimes the questions are more important than the answers. Because I don't think you're going to find an answer to that, but the question could change your life.
Let's have another.
There's somebody up here at the front there.
Hi, I'm going to try and make this into a question, but it's actually a bit of a reflection as well on some of the things that were said earlier in your conversation.
What's your name, by the way?
Sorry, yeah, that thing. My name's Daliani. I just finished a master's in philosophy, so another philosophy person, sorry.
Okay.
yeah, we're the ones that think we have the things to say.
Yeah, do you not like him? Yeah, I'm
going to
sit down
him.
The front
sure
on my
lovely.
Own. Okay.
Okay, so when you were saying about, when you asked everyone how many of you are disappointed with the Sunday sermons, I felt it's a bit of an unfair question, because it's not about disappointment and satisfaction when you come to a sermon. There is a conversation going on, and it's, I suppose the question is going to be about your reflection on what my comment is. To me, when you are faced with a difficulty and maybe you're coming to a sermon hoping to find an answer or hoping to find a revelation of some sort, you have to give the space for hearing an answer, and sometimes that's not, and sometimes you have to shut off what you think the answer should be. And it's just about saying, okay, I have no idea what the answer is, but if I just leave it completely open, then perhaps I'll pick something out. It's, so I see it more as a conversation, and the congregation has as much as a duty to give space to the preacher as the preacher does to try his or her best to say something that's relevant to them at that time, and yeah, at that time and for that community.
Can I say first of all that I don't think I've ever told anyone this before, but when I kneel to pray in Mass, before Mass, I always say, please help the priest, inspire the priest today, and help him to give us the words to help us. And when I come away from a Mass thinking, that was a rubbish sermon, one of the things I think about being a believer is that you don't think that for very long before you think, actually, is this a good way to be? I think, as I said earlier, sometimes I can be a tough audience and I want so much from that priest. But I think you're being, if I may say, a little ideal about it, because I think there are certain basic oratorial skills, such as, I used to write a column for the Times newspaper, and when I spoke to the editor, I said, what do you think about doing this job? They said, one thing, only ever met one point in a column. Don't stop moving around. One point, that's what people want. One point fully expressed and made well. I rarely hear a sermon where they adopt that rule. They lightly touch upon. It's like a stone skimming across the water. So, yeah, I want to give them, these are the priests of my church. I desperately want them to move me and to move everyone else. I recognize that I can be demanding about that, and I don't like that about me, and I try to stop myself being that person. I still believe, however, that I just want them all to be sat in a room by someone who knows how to do it and be told how to do it. And I think they'd be happy because they would see it and people would come up. If ever I do hear a good sermon, I always, always say to the priest on the way out, by the way, I really enjoyed the homily today. It's really interesting. And I think that point I made before, which was a kind of a gag, they don't get much applause. I think they do need a bit more encouragement. Someone told me they were in a church and someone started talking and a person said, hold on, can I ask a question about this sermon? Now, if that happened in a Catholic church, everyone would go, it's the Antichrist that's turned up. Maybe, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was at university, I often got a lot more out of seminars than I did out of lectures. Maybe it should be made more democratic. Maybe it should be a Q&A. I don't know, but I don't think, I'm not happy to just say they're doing their best and it needs to be better. I want it to be better. And if someone, you know, my girlfriend used to come to church with me. She stopped because she said, you know, it's boring. And I found it, I thought, how can this be boring? It's the most knockout story. It's better than Harry Potter as a story goes, and we're not flogging it. So I agree, but I disagree. There's a man over there who might be not seen because he's tucked away in a corner, by the way, and that would be wrong.
Thank you.
My name's Ian. I'm an ex-biologist who thinks that Richard Dawkins has written beautifully about evolution, but I'll say no more about that. I just wonder, why are there so many religions? Are they all true?
Should I start?
Yeah, you start. This is what they call, on Question of Sport, a home question.
I don't think that religion
is just one of those universal categories. Religions happen because they have historical points of origin, great teachers, great insights, movements, something crystallizes. So every religion has a history, a beginning of some kind. And in a diverse world, you're going to have diverse expressions of whatever insights and teachings there are. I find it impossible to say that outside the Christian church there is no truth. Equally, I would not be a Christian if I didn't think that this movement, this history, this life contained a far greater resource of coping with reality, coping with the truth, than others. I wouldn't be a Christian if I didn't think that. So I don't think it's a zero-sum game. Only one is right, all the rest are totally wrong. It's not a binary opposition like that. It's a very, very complicated set of cultural histories. My commitment is to this history, this vision, because I believe it does give more room eventually for full humanity than others do. And others will say, if you like, the equal and opposite to me. I know that. But there's no tribunal to adjudicate between those. I make my commitment. I will argue it with the Muslim or the Sikh when I have to. But I don't believe that I'm arguing into a void there. And I think Richard Dawkins writes beautifully about evolution too.
Shall I get a go?
Yes.
This is my away question. I haven't read Richard Dawkins on evolution, but I'm not anti-evolution. See, you stereotyping us straight away. Even the Pope said he thought that. I always imagine it's a kind of like God planted this tree and then he left it to grow. Anyway, it's evolution sorted. Don't you ever think it's weird, though? If you ever look at pictures of Darwin, look around the eyes. He's got the most chimpanzee-like eyes you have ever seen. I can see how he looked in the mirror and thought, you know what? However, I have to say, this is something I've moved on quite a lot over the years, and I think this is the first time we might disagree this evening, because I think it's a very good question, why are there so many religions? And if I can answer this, if you'll indulge me, as a football fan. Football fans, and you don't need to know about football to, I'm not going to start talking in details, but ultimately, they love this game. There's something about watching this game, the beautiful flowing movement, and we all love that. That's what unites us. There's something, and like religion, it's very hard to explain it to people who aren't interested in football. I could talk about it all day, and you wouldn't know what I meant. But you know that well-known saying that those who dance are thought mad by those that cannot hear the music. It applies to religion, it applies to football as well. But, such is the nature of football, yeah, I've got my team who I support. And every football fan, I don't know any football fans who are just football fans. They all have some sort of allegiance to a team, no matter how tenuous. In other words, this love of this great game is compartmentalized into a tribalism. So, when I went to football in the 80s, when football hooliganism was a big deal, people would be clubbing each other because they had different colors on. They all loved football, they had that unifying thing, but it was a different team. And in fact, if you break it down, it's not about players. That's not what draws us in. It's not about even about the clubs. It's about this brilliant game. And I sometimes think that religion could learn from that, because I think belief that there's something else up there. I sometimes think there's too many words, too much doctrine. I don't know if you've read Karen Armstrong's book on the Bible. If you haven't, I would really recommend it. It's the best book on the Bible I have ever read. And in it, she talks about a challenge made to a chief rabbi. And someone said to him, "You know a lot of scripture. Can you stand on one leg and recite everything that's in the Bible?" And he said, "Yes." So they all sat down thinking this was going to be a 3-day job. He stood on one leg and he said, "Love God and love one another." Then he put his leg down and said, "Everything else is commentary." And I think, you know what Gandhi said about, you know, if, okay, be a Muslim, be a Sikh, be a Christian, but be a good Muslim and a good Sikh. I think every religion that I know about can be broken down to the basic bricks of compassion. And I sometimes wish that we noticed that that was our common denominator more than the fact that I kneel with my left leg instead of my right leg. So I'm kind of with the biologist on this one. And I, if anything, I think at a time when secularism is a threat to the salvation of millions, that we shouldn't just be talking about the Catholic Church and Anglicans getting together. Maybe believers should get together and try and find what we've got in common and try and sell that. I didn't see one clergyman clapping there. I think this is my job you're talking about.
We've got, let's see, a couple down there and one here.
Hello, my name's Ken and I work at Transform. Do you believe that drugs should be legalized in this country for the benefit of reducing crime? And as Jesus looked like a hippie, do you think he would support that?
I'm leaving the hippie questions to you.
I think why. I'd need to know exactly what drugs you had in mind, but...
Hold on a minute. Which drugs would you legalise, Your Grace?
That's one of those questions that sort of, when did you stop beating your wife, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean that... I recognize the enormous implication of drug use in crime of every kind in this country, and not only this country. And I recognize that the illegality of a good many drugs, especially hard drugs, drives deprivation, criminality in all sorts of contexts. What I can't make up my mind about, and I'm sorry to be wishy-washy and Anglican about it, is whether the answer is legalization. Now, there was a point in this country where it was possible for addicts to cope with their addiction through prescription, and that sort of faded away a bit after the 60s. I'm talking about, you know, heroin and drugs of that sort. And things have changed radically. I don't think we'd just go back to that earlier situation where you could see a case for the legalization of hard drugs. I don't think we can go back to that. And that's my perplexity here. I don't know. I don't know. I think that it would be very, very difficult to unscramble the situation we've got into now. But I recognize that there is an enormous issue about the way in which drug abuse fuels criminality and vice versa. And if I had an answer to that, I'd be a much wiser man.
Can I ask, was that the church bells or was it your car alarm?
Customized car alarm.
I hope you've got a ringtone that sounds like that. It's a difficult question, but I know a few people who've been completely ruined by drugs, and there's a lot of hypocrisy about it. You know, I know people who do cocaine and who condemn me for shopping at Primark because they might use sweatshops. And cocaine is gathered and all sorts of terrible crime and horrible stuff goes on. I think it's pretty hard to justify the legalization of it. And I don't know what you do about all the crime that surrounds it. It's so difficult, but I would be loath to say, yeah, help yourself, go for it, help yourselves, because I think it's kind of, we're back to cool again, it's kind of cool to say, yeah, drugs, it's great, and I don't think it is. That's the non-rock and roll stance.
Vote for that. We can take another question from here. Up in the front, please. Could you stand? Then they'll know where you are.
Mike Field, I'm a journalist. Can I go back to...
Who are you with, Mike?
Last interview, Frank, was with you.
Right.
Do you remember?
Okay, so who are you with, Mike?
ITV.
ITV, okay. Don't be ashamed.
No, well...
Confession time, is
yeah.
it?
Can I go back to your idea, fascinating idea of elite sermons, and following up a couple of questions ago, apparently the old Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, when he was at his local church, constantly interrupted the vicar because he disagreed with what he was saying. And I wondered if we could, in fact, it's sometimes in church, instead of a sermon, have a discussion. I mean, would that work?
I mean, I imagine, Your Grace, that this is a common thing as a kind of a secondary thing in the church, isn't it? Around that there are discussion groups and stuff.
Probably not enough, though. I think in the last couple of decades, people have recognized much more what an appetite there is for discussion, and there's more than there used to be. It's much rarer to have a structured discussion in church, partly because most churches aren't designed for discussions, as witness the acoustic problems that you face an evening like this.
Also, if you had a vote on it with a congregation, I wonder how many people would want it. I mean, I don't know if it's true, but have you ever been to a Quaker meeting? I'm told that they sit around in silence and wait for inspiration to come, and then someone will stand up and speak, which sounds like really exciting to me, but I think a lot of people would find that very intimidating. So I think, am I right in saying that we've kind of got the service that we deserve in a way? I don't know, whenever I've been, I mean, we've had some interesting questions tonight, but I'm not sure if you wouldn't get the same people dominating the conversation. And, what are you laughing at? And, oh, come on, I'm up here. And, I mean, I love the idea of it, but I still don't think it's as good as better sermons. I'm going to stick with that. By the way, can I ask you, you actually work for ITV, as in the television network. Pardon? Do you, Red or Black, the program that was on recently with Ant and Dec, would you agree with me that that was Red and Black, the colours of Lucifer, I think you'd agree. I wonder if it was the beginning of the end times. It seemed to be a talent show with no talent needed other than saying Red or Black. And I actually started to think this is the falling away now of civilization. I wonder if Ant is short for Antichrist. And Dec for December, meaning the dark times, the end of days. There was one, I don't know if you watched it, Your Grace, but there was one show when in order to decide on Red or Black, they pulled feathers out of an angel's wings. How much symbolism do we need? So I think you should have a look around at ITV and see if it isn't, in fact, the agency of the devil.
Well, we could move on to another production, An Appropriate Adult, which had a lot of jokes in it, which was the program about Fred West, brilliantly played by Dominic West. Mm. And there were, as macabre a story as it was, did you see it? There were a lot of jokes.
A lot of jokes in the Fred West documentary.
Yeah.
Right.
Good old ITV.
I think we better leave that as a theological possibility rather than certainty. but one last question from down there. Will you stand, please?
My name's Susie. I'm a prison chaplain. And sometimes on a Sunday morning, I have a congregation of about 50 young men. I feel like what I'm doing is stand-up comedy. I wondered if you'd ever thought that your feelings of frustration when you're listening to a sermon could be God calling you to do better.
Wow. And I thought this was a captive audience. Yeah, I did think that at one point. My girlfriend said I'd make a great priest. Yeah, you know, it nagged at me as well. But I don't think I had the courage. I'm too old now. I actually sound like tonight I've condemned priests and vicars and whatever, which I didn't mean to do. I kind of feel with the sermon thing, it's like we are not a very responsive crowd in a church. And I know tonight the worst answer I gave was the drug answer. I know I wasn't happy with it. The response wasn't that good. It was a bit scrappy. I might think a bit more about it now. I sometimes think with my local priest, he does a bad sermon and he doesn't know. No one tells him. He doesn't get a response anyway. And so it goes on and it goes on. And I honestly have fantastic admiration for priests of any religion. And maybe it's just about feedback. I'm not saying I could do any better, but I'm in church, I can't lie. I think I probably could.
I think it's not just feedback. I think the essence of a good sermon is somehow being able to convey why it matters, which means passion about it. I think you've actually shared some of your passion about it with us. And
well, you too, Your Grace.
Thank you. I think now we do have to wrap up, but I don't want to finish without saying, on behalf of everybody, what a delight it's been to have you as our guest here.
Well, it's been an honour, really, to be here. Thank you very much. Thank you.